You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh, boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into Tuscaloosa.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
Just so we can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight. Then that snows.
The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Madison.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on the Weather Junkies. We have a very exciting episode tonight, but let me introduce myself. I'm Tyler Jankowski, as always, joining the show from Connecticut, and we have Dakota with us this week in Colorado.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Weather Junkies. Nice to be with you again. Tyler, nice to talk to you again. It is fall in Colorado. Fall has come. It is crisp. It is cool. Some of the leaves are starting to change. I love it. I love fall. It was a hot summer, so I'm ready to bundle up out here and looking forward to our first snow, which we can expect hopefully sometime in October or November. Tyler, how's the weather on the East Coast? You guys seeing fall yet?
We are. Finally, it's beautiful out. There's not a cloud in the sky. The sun has set and temperatures are in the 70s, but we're bound for the 40s tonight. It'll really be one of the first widespread 40-degree nights that we've seen this season. So excited for that. I love when you can sleep with the windows open and wake up and you hear the birds chirping and sometimes the leaves fluttering, a little bit of a breeze. It's a really nice time of year. I love snow, but I'm not quite ready for winter. So it's a tough part of the year because it's so nice, but it drops off pretty quick.
Yeah, our winter is kind of long and we get snow early, so
I like snow. I just don't like the gray and dingy part of winter that lasts so long.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Before we get into our tweets this week, I wanted to address something that we've been having a little bit of fun with. If you listen to the Stormfront Freaks, we were on their show in the summer. That was a great time. But we threw a little kind of shade at them after they threw some shade at us. They criticized our a segment that we just did, Weather in Our Backyard, saying that you could Google it. And I made a quick reference. Tyler, you didn't even know about it, but I said, you know, have you heard of Google? You can forecast it, get your forecast there. And they picked up on that and thought it was funny and a little bit of a wisecrack. I just didn't understand why they, you know, had a problem with the weather in the backyard. It takes a few minutes to talk about it. And, you know, it's really just me and you catching up. That's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you don't listen to them, give them a listen. They're great. There's a little bit of a weather podcast battle, I believe, right now. It's all fun and games, but let's move on to our tweets of the week section here. Our first tweet comes from Trevor Bauscher. Hopefully I'm saying his name right. You can follow him at ZombieTrev5K. And his tweet's from the National Weather Association conference that they have every year. And his tweet says, the watch and warning periodic table of confusion. And he has a nice picture of a bunch of different colors. And the watch and warnings those colors represent in kind of a periodic table fashion, similar to the elements. If you can't see this, check it out on our site, weatherjunkies.com. And you can see it there. Tyler, I'm curious, do you use the National Weather Service colors when you broadcast on air? Do you ever change it?
95% of the time, we use the National Weather Service colors. But the only instance where we don't is perhaps the most important, and that's when it comes to severe weather. I think most people consider severe warnings or short fuse warnings to be flash flood, tornado, and severe thunderstorm. For severe thunderstorm, we use the same color, basically. But for tornado, we use magenta. And for flash flood, we use green. I've had at least one person tell me that they don't think green is a good color because green generally means go or good. I like green because for some reason, green feels like rain to me. Yeah. And I do love magenta for a tornado because it stands out. I mean, your heart sinks when you see magenta on the map. But I'm not sure how that came about, but that's what we use.
Huh, interesting. So I took a look at this, and I've been interested in the colors that various people use in the Weather Enterprise. When we had a post about it called the Watch and Warning Rainbow. So if you didn't check that out, take a look at that on our site. Similar, they just did it more extensively. So it's a topic that definitely goes around, and they're hoping to get a little bit more of consistency and simplicity in the National Weather Service when it comes to color.
I mean, when you look at the colors, it almost makes you think that the colors were not chosen for any kind of reason to convey danger. I mean, almost every color is used, so it seems to me like they wanted to make sure the colors were different. That was the goal. Just different.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And they kind of got wrapped up, and they couldn't stop making different colors. And interesting topic.
And our next tweet is from Stu Ostro. He is on Twitter at Stu Ostro, and his bio says, weather obsessed, weather geek, and proud to be. And he is a senior meteorologist at the Weather Channel. And his tweet is, oh boy. the first word is it by at in the eye of extreme typhoon Meranti. And he says hashtag #FertiPH. Not quite sure what everything in that tweet means, but the image that is attached to it is amazing. I mean, there's a little island there. I guess it's it by at. The island in the middle of that typhoon. I would assume that's the eye, right?
Yeah, that's the eye of Meranti, and the eye wall is very symmetric. The whole storm is very symmetric and very powerful. And I can't imagine what kind of conditions they experienced on this island before and after the eye was over them. Because you know, when the eye's over them, it's all calm and clear. But that eye wall contains dangerous winds and
you could probably get a heck of a picture right while the storm is directly overhead from left to right.
Yeah, like one of those 360 pictures.
Almost like the plane in the middle, except you're just on land.
Yeah, I would be so scared to be on that island while this was happening. I actually don't know if it's a very populated island or not. Hopefully not, or hopefully they evacuated it before this happened. So I wanted to move on. That's it for the tweets this week. We're introducing a new segment similar to Tweets of the Week, but called Read of the Week. And every week, Tyler and I will introduce something that we've been reading that we really like and send it your guys' way so that you can listen, read it and tell us what you think about it. This week, it's The Capital Weather Gang, and it's kind of an obvious choice for myself and Tyler, because they have some of the best weather content on the web. They're part of the Washington Post, and they provide daily weather for the DC area. But they also provide some national weather coverage when it comes to high impact weather events. And some of my favorite things that they do is when they call out different organizations, different media organizations that are doing the public a disservice when it comes to disseminating science, whether it's climate or weather, particularly during the Hurricane Hermine coverage. They blasted a few news organizations for their erroneous coverage of the tropics. I actually don't know if it was Hermine yet when they put that out, but it was just a wonderful read, and they do a great job with covering high-impact events accurately and succinctly. And if you haven't read them yet or visited their site, go check them out. I think they're capitalweathergang.com. You can just Google them as well, and you can find them on our site as well. Give them a read. They're really good, and you won't regret it.
Yeah, I do agree. Usually when something big happens in the weather community, they tend to be the voice of reason, and whatever they write gets shared by a lot of notable sources online. And I will say they do a nice job of stating accurate facts and things that are not controversial, because I know there are blogs and websites out there that post things that turn my stomach and I would never retweet. But they do a nice job of posting things that are very reasonable.
Yeah, on the whole, they do a very, very good job. This segment was actually suggested by a viewer, or listener, I guess, of ours, Stephen Bry. I actually go to school with him, but he listens every week, and he said, hey, you know, I'd really like to know what you guys are reading when it comes to weather. Thanks, Steve. And if you like this segment or you don't like it, let us know. I'd appreciate some feedback on that.
And now on to the main part of our show this evening. We are very lucky to have two guests on from Jardine Lloyd Thompson Capital Markets. We are joined by Ryan Fitzpatrick and Brian Bastian. Welcome, guys.
Welcome. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is great.
We are talking about a topic we really haven't covered much on the Weather Junkies here over the last 9 or so months, but we want to start out with introductions. We want to learn a little bit about you guys and what you do and the company you work for, and then we'll get into a few questions to dive deeper into what you do. But Ryan, why don't you start off? You wanted to be on the podcast, and we're happy to have you. Tell us a little bit about you, how you got started, and where you are now.
Sure, great. I'm Ryan Fitzpatrick. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Jardine Lloyd Thompson Capital Markets, Inc. I've been a financial services professional for about 20 years now. I've worked at a bunch of different investment banks and trading shops along the way. And right now I'm focused on working in the insurance-linked market space and the insurance M&A field. And that's kind of how I came to you guys. Is I was on a plane on my way to Manitoba, Canada, working on a weather project, and I was listening to a bunch of different podcasts, and I came across yours, and I thought, well, this is a great place for me to kind of talk about and kind of expand to the general public kind of what we're doing and how it's how our products and how this actual marketplace works. Because I don't think there's a lot of knowledge out there about what we do and how we do it, and I thought this would be a great meeting of for both of us. Our primary focus is around insurance-linked securities, which would be better known as catastrophe bonds or cat bonds, and that's basically taking what is in the reinsurance space, turning them into bond products and selling them on to asset managers or structuring them for asset managers to invest in, which is seen a large push since the financial crisis of 2008 because these products are not correlated to other markets. You know, basically a hurricane doesn't really care if the Dow Jones is at 10,000 or 15,000. A hurricane's going to do what it's going to do, and the result is not correlated to any market. Our second kind of main line of business is insurance mergers and acquisitions or advisory, where we advise on companies investing in or setting up or doing all the traditional advisory work around insurance companies. Our third line, I would call, would be doing bespoke weather hedges for corporate clients. So imagine a corporation that is has multiple business lines, but all could be impacted by weather. And most businesses could be impacted by weather, but a simple example would be a ski resort. If a ski resort, there's no snow, then they're going to have a hard time making revenue. Their costs go up, their margins increase because they have to make snow. There's a customer preference for natural snow versus man-made snow. There is an ice component, and all these different factors, you know, play into the analysis, and then developing products for our clients on a one-off basis is how we work. So that's kind of the 50,000 foot view, which I'm sure you'll have some questions after that.
Yeah, that's a lot to dive into, and we'll do that in a minute. I wanted to get the background from Brian here. You brought a meteorologist with you, and Brian, we actually went to school together. You, me, and Tyler. So just kind of, how did you get here after you got your degree at Penn State in meteorology, and what are you doing now?
Sure. Thank you. And I sort of have an interesting, even in my short career post undergrad at Penn State, going to school with the two of you. I've had kind of an interesting ride. Long story short, my first job out of school was with a defense contractor, which at the time was called the SI organization. And I was actually working on a geospatial solution or platform in the commercial space where the idea was, how do we leverage core competencies that as a defense contractor we had, how do we leverage those instead of in the government space but in the commercial space? And that was actually my first introduction to actually microfinance and weather derivatives, and I was actually introduced to a company at the time called Nephila Advisors at that job. And I was there for about 2.5 years, and after 2.5 years I had the opportunity to come work for Jardine Lloyd Thompson, although not in the capital markets group, which Ryan is involved with, but JLT has a reinsurance business, a reinsurance brokerage business, and my role is in the catastrophe, what's our official name, Catastrophe Exposure and Risk Management Services. That's the team. long name, but that's the team I'm on. And part of my role as a meteorologist on that team is to support the Ryan and his guys on the capital markets team, primarily in evaluating weather derivatives, bespoke hedging, weather hedging products, and how do we develop new ones that can address some of the tough problems that our clients face that simply either it's not affordable to do in the reinsurance market, or it's simply better to do in the capital market space. And so that kind of brings me to today. And so I've sort of had a unique young career to begin with, but I certainly love my role as a meteorologist to sort of not only leverage my technical meteorology background through my studies at Penn State, but also to apply a lot of the work that Ryan's team does in the capital market space with economics and certainly business and finance. And how do you really leverage our understanding about climatology and about meteorology to make smarter decisions and make better investment choices? And we do that on a consultancy basis with our clients. So that's sort of where I'm at.
So I read some of the documents that you sent along. They were fascinating. I know, Ryan, you mentioned ski areas. I saw examples of wineries and obviously a lot of farms in the Midwest. Can you provide us a simple example of how one of those businesses benefits from what you do and explain the process of reinsurance for someone that may have never even heard the word before?
Sure. So I think there's a couple different themes there, right? So let's break it down into two parts. Let's talk about the idea of how a farm or someone who's in agriculture could benefit from our products. So if we think about, and this is one that Brian and I worked on together, and I think this is a pretty cool one, is that, and Brian can go into the meteorological aspect of it a lot better than I can, but we worked with a large cattle producer, and we came up with a concept for them that they had a bunch of feedlots in, called the Southwest region. And I went out there and we talked to them about putting a weather hedge on, and we contemplated working on cattle mortality, specifically around the feedlots as they develop a microclimate, and I'll let Brian touch on that. But when we actually spoke to the client, they weren't necessarily concerned about cattle mortality due to extreme heat conditions. They were real, and these are beef producers. They were concerned about the production. that if the weather was either too cold, if there's too much snow on the ground, or there was too much heat, that the cows wouldn't put the appropriate weight on. And then if it was something idiosyncratic to their own, you know, localized weather system versus the rest of the entire region, then they would be exposed because the price of beef may be at X and their cows weren't putting on the weight to support that, and their margins would then shrink. So it's about their revenue smoothing across the across their balance sheet, and trying to hedge that idiosyncratic risk to either a location or across a portfolio, insofar as that how the weather can impact them. Did that make sense to you, or do I need to break it down a little bit?
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. And I'll let Brian touch on what was going on when we looked at the actual the feedlots themselves.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I was going to say, and just to kind of give another little high-level view here for you, because Ryan mentioned smoothing of a balance sheet, and for folks who may not necessarily, I know I didn't necessarily understand that, especially as a meteorology major. I was like, what does smoothing a balance sheet means? And it sort of connects with the initial question I think you guys had, which had to do with, you know, what is the role sort of reinsurance? And certainly reinsurance plays a role from a catastrophe standpoint. So major, in the case of these feedlots, it might be extreme drought or extreme wetness, you know, flooding, or it could mean, you know, extreme blizzard that would cause not necessarily the cattle to die, as Ryan mentioned, but they're just simply not able to eat enough to sustain weight. And so the idea of smoothing the balance sheet, at the end of the day, this particular beef producer, they have to report back to their stakeholders, and they might be publicly traded, so it could be shareholders, or it could just be other folks who are invested in that particular company. And if there's anything that shareholders or stakeholders within a company hate more, is volatility in the valuation of the company. And catastrophes, and this is where reinsurance really comes into play, catastrophes can cause quite a bit of volatility in the value of a company, particularly for a beef producer. If they're not able to produce as much beef and their share price or their stock price or whatever goes way down, a lot of people won't be too happy. So that's where sort of reinsurance and using these weather hedges as a means of providing a type of reinsurance comes into play. And certainly from a meteorologist standpoint, you know, I work hand in hand with somebody like Brian who understands more of the financial markets aspect. I can come into his world and say from a meteorology, like the underlying asset that we're trying to protect, in this case, this could have been cattle within a feedlot, what are those weather or weather catastrophe-related drivers that could mean extreme losses for this particular client? And this was an interesting one with the feedlots because we had to think a lot about, and I worked in tandem with a couple of the other meteorologists on my team who have actually a bit more experience than I do, especially in the agricultural space, in getting some more information and trying to really understand what the core problem was. With feedlots, you run into an issue with microclimates. Microclimates in the sense of while the ambient temperature, let's say at the nearest, you know, airport that's, you know, sensing, you know, the temperature there, that could be, let's say it's, you know, 75 degrees at night. When you get in around these feedlots, if you actually look at an aerial view of where these feedlots are actually placed, it's surrounded by corn. And at least within the peak summer months, you get this really interesting feedback mechanism between the evapotranspiration from the corn. Obviously, when it's at peak maturity stage, it's going to be evapotranspirating quite a bit, so you're going to get relative humidities that rise, and it gets to the point where the cattle almost suffocate because the ambient temperature at night is so high, and the feedback from the corn that surrounds the feedlot makes the relative humidity 100%. And so you can get a lot of problems with cattle mortality there. You can also get issues with the cows actually not being able to eat enough. And that was just on the heat and sort of the humidity side. We actually looked at blizzard conditions as well, the frequency and severity of blizzards impacting the areas where this particular cattle producer had exposure. They actually had feedlots. So the meteorology really works hand in hand. We have to understand fundamentally what the problem is. What is the client trying to hedge against? What risk, what are they exposed to? How can we dive into the meteorological data that's available to us? And typically we want to look for places, or pieces of information or parameters that have a pretty decent amount of history, so we could look and see how a particular instrument would have performed historically, and then ultimately put that in front of the client and see if it's going to help them answer their questions or solve their problems. Yeah, that was a long-winded answer, but that's what I got.
Yeah, and I think that the second part to your question was, you know, how does reinsurance, you know, help everything? So I just want to clarify. So your typical insurance policy, right, would be something along the lines from a property standpoint is, I have homeowner's insurance, right? A simple policy. So that insurance company, in a lot of cases, says, well, you know what, I'm carrying too much risk, or it's mandated by the state that you have to have a certain number of you know, make sure you have enough capital. And the way that the insurance carrier would do that is that they would buy reinsurance. In other words, they would then hedge their risk. So just like someone may, if you were betting on a football game or you were in the stock market, that you would then take off some risk from your position and say, well, you know, I'm betting on the Cowboys today, but I like the under, or some other type of function like that. Or if you were thinking about, you know, buying a stock, and you would write a call. Same type of concept in the insurance space, and that function, it would be reinsurance. What we're talking about generally when we talk about weather hedging, you know, or weather derivatives. I don't really like derivatives because our products could be, they're form agnostic, so they could be in a swap form, basically trade your risk for a premium, or they could be in a policy format, typical pay a premium and then you have a payout if something occurs, or they could even be in a bond form, where it could be syndicated amongst asset managers and then could be deployed in a bunch of other strategies depending on how the asset manager wants to use it. So I would call it weather hedging as opposed to weather derivatives or reinsurance for the purposes of our conversation. But it's the same concept is you want to take the risk and you want to transfer it to someone else via a vehicle. And the way that we do that is by working with our meteorological team and diving into what the data actually shows and figuring out, you know, is there too much rain in this location and what would that impact? How would that impact someone's balance sheet? How does that impact their potential to earn, and what happens if that does, and then we back into all those different issues, and then we work on building a product in that way.
So this conversation brings a whole new meaning to stakeholders, you know, because it's the cattle industry. I had to do it, and I know it's terrible.
Walked into that one.
Yeah. So I wanted to get a little bit more about the weather and I guess forecast that you're providing. I guess this might be more of a question for Brian. So who are you giving this information to, and what kind of time scale are you looking at? Is it a short term, medium term, or like long term weather that you're looking at?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, certainly I'll tell you right now, I'm not a forecaster. So I am not going to say what the weather is going to do. What I will typically do, the way it sort of, Ryan mentioned, you need a vehicle, so you need some sort of contract in place that actually states conditions and exclusions and policy period and the whole nine yards. You need some form of structure to actually transfer this risk. And so in order to facilitate that process, you know, we partner with other organizations to put together something that we can place ultimately in front of the client and say, hey, is this something that you would be, is this a way you would like to write off this particular form of risk? And so my job as a meteorologist is to take sort of the conditions and, you know, you've probably heard terms like strike price or, you know, mentioned swaps or whatever the function of the instrument is, however it's being designed. And typically there's some form of underlying meteorological data So in the case of temperature, precipitation, you'll be looking at rainfall or degrees Celsius, or in the case of energy, it might be heating or cooling degree days. So you take the underlying parameters of the data, and usually you're using some sort of what they would call like a proxy location to, so it might be a weather station, a place that has a history of providing consistent, accurate, and complete data. And so my job is to do more of like a, they would call it a burn analysis, and it's to take the existing conditions as defined by this risk transfer vehicle and basically run it through the climatology of whatever that meteorological data is and evaluate how it would have performed in the past. So it's not a forecast, it's actually a past cast. It's saying, okay, if we take these conditions and we look backwards in time, how would that particular vehicle or contract have paid out? Either how would it have paid out to investors, depending on the point of view, or how would it have paid out to the particular client? Because in most cases, again, they're using as a weather hedge, which means they're looking for some form of settlement given that certain values are exceeded, whether it's, you know, number of degrees in a day or a certain period of time, or inches of rain that happen over a period of time, or inches of rain that don't happen over a period of time. And so that's a very good question, because I think most meteorologists, they think of our role as being primarily in forecasting and looking at weather models and predicting what the weather will do. Whereas I'm more of the mindset of, okay, let me take what we know and how would that have performed in the past? And can we use that as the insight and information we need to say how this could perform looking out into the future?
So back to the example of the cattle farm. So when you convince someone to sign up and use your services, explain how the financials work. So they pay a certain amount each month or each year, and then something happens, and then you pay them a certain amount?
So the way it would work generally, and there's very different ways we could structure this. So I'll give you a couple examples. So the way it generally works is that we come and we figure out what is the issue. And the issue in this case would be excess heat and then excess of cold with snowfall on the other end. So during certain months, right, call it June, July, and August, if the heat reached above X, then for a certain determined number of days, right, we'll call that Y, and if that event occurs, then the product would pay out. So someone would pay on a quarterly basis whatever that premium is. So we would derive what we think that risk is warranted or the expected loss. And then we would look to a market to kind of say, okay, I would be willing to buy this risk from them. And if they bought the risk from them, it would have to be at this price. For the purposes here, we'll call the person who is selling the risk the risk seller, and the person who's buying the risk would be the risk buyer. And what occurs is they pay them a premium, right? Like you would if you pay a premium on your insurance at your home. If the event occurs, then the premium would then pay, product would then pay. So usually this is done, we could do this in a number of different ways. We could, it could be done in a collateralized vehicle where money would sit in a trust account, or if the client who is the protection, the risk seller, if they felt comfortable with who the counterparty was, then they would just say, okay, you're a AAA rated entity, we will trust that you will have the money should something occur. And then we would make the work with the contract in such a way that everything is specified, clear, simple, so that there's no ambiguity. And then when that occurs, the protection or the risk buyer would then pay the risk seller. Does that make sense?
It does. I would like you to elaborate on the difference then between basic insurance and reinsurance.
Well, so the difference here is that these products can be done in an insurance policy standpoint, right? Reinsurance is a function, you know, the term was used and probably confused matters a little bit, but the reinsurance is generally for an insurance company that is looking to hedge their risk, and so they purchase coverage or policy in a reinsurance agreement, right? So they're taking that insurance policy, they're bundling them together, and they're selling that off to someone else to take that risk. These products that we're talking about are not reinsurance. They can be reinsurance, but what they are just transferring weather-related risk is the way that we should think about it. Is that if I have weather risk, whether I am the New York Yankees and I'm concerned about rain, but it's not a rain out and my concessions get impacted, I'm, you know, a ski resort, I'm a cattle producer, I'm a pineapple producer in Panama, I'm a salvage company that operates, in marine, or something of the like, a construction company, a port, that I have wind issues. All of these different components can be, those risks can be hedged. So it's not reinsurance, and reinsurance is specific to an insurance company. We should call it risk transfer. And risk transfer is about taking the risk that you have and then offloading it off your balance sheet onto someone else's balance sheet.
That makes sense. So when it comes to the conditions that you set, you want to make sure that you don't set the bar too low so that they're triggered too often.
Well, yeah. Well, so you can. The difference is a lot of people have the view of insurance being a couple of things. One, that it's cheap. Two, that when something does happen, it doesn't really pay. And three, if it does pay, it takes a really long time to get it. These products are not that. These products are designed that if you want to structure something that's a 1-in-5-year event, we can do that. But it's going to cost you, you know, money. It's going to cost about 25% or so, ballpark, of whatever the insured value you're trying to, for lack of a better term, or the notional of what you're trying to hedge. Now, what the art in this is trying to find that line where there's an event that is something beyond the normal weather pattern, you know, of every 5 or 10 years, that is significant enough to cause a corporate or another entity, whether it's a government, some, you know, lack of a better term, pain, cause significant damage to them, but isn't so remote that it will never pay out. And finding that balance is the art in how we service our clients. You know, if you think, and how we structure the products can all depend on, you know, finding that line of where it's more advantageous on pricing to be a 1-in-5-year event or a 1-in-6-year event, and what the trade-off is and how that works for the client's benefit is really, you know, what our value add is understanding and looking at what that risk is and working with our meteorologists and figuring out how can I best protect my client for what they are willing to pay. And that's how I view what our key role is.
So I was perusing your website and I noticed that there was a really nice write-up on Hurricane Hermine. And I was wondering, was there anything behind the scenes that you guys were doing during Hermine, advising your clients, I guess in Florida and even on the East Coast?
That's probably a good question for me, huh, Ron?
Yeah.
So this is a good thing this would come back to before I dig into that. The JLT as a company has a few different businesses, and so you know we're on today in particular talking about what JLT does in the capital market side. So through weather hedging, insurance-linked securities, insurance-linked warranties, catastrophe bonds. But there is this other part of the business, which is reinsurance brokerage, and that's the part of JLT that I support capital markets. That's my primary role, and a big part of that. And so we're actually brokering the insurance for insurance companies. So that's actually going back to this idea of like reinsurance. It really is insurance for insurance companies, and they are very much the claims managers and the highest level people within that client base. The insurers who are our clients, they wanted to know, you know, what was the deal with Hermine? Because if it were to, it exited into the Atlantic, it actually ended up veering a little bit more east, which was great, you know, from a claim standpoint. But had it hugged, you know, the East Coast, I think a bit more, you could have seen more inland flooding. You could have seen more wind speeds that were generated closer to the coastline. And if that were the case, we could have seen more claims for our clients that had, you know, Jersey coastline exposure or Long Island exposure. And so what you're seeing there, Dakota, on the website there is our catastrophe activity zone, our CATS blog, that myself and two other meteorologists on our team, we have an earthquake specialist as well, that we put together for current events like these to support our insurance, our clients who are insurers. And those insurers may or may not work with our capital markets group if they're looking for an alternative form of risk transfer. So that instead of going to the reinsurance markets, they can use the capital markets as a means to hedge risk on their end. And so that's sort of that's the dynamic between the two groups. So what you're seeing there is actually a function of our reinsurance entity, not so much the capital markets team. Hopefully that cleared things up at least.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess after an event, say for instance the recent Louisiana flooding, do you guys have a role in assessing, I guess, what kind of damages, not assessing, but I guess, you know, people go out and assess the damages and insurance companies get all these claims. What do you guys, is there anything that you guys do in that process?
So I think I'll take this one. So there is a couple different ways these things work. We JLT Re, or the reinsurance group, has a claims team, and they work hand in hand with insurers to deal with how the claims work between reinsurance, and we work with our clients on that front. But some of the products that can be created kind of, for lack of a better term, structurally avoid that process, and that's a very good fit for the non-catastrophic weather hedge, and that's kind of what we've been talking about a lot of. So the way some of the products can be structured is I could structure a product that would say wouldn't need some sort of proof of loss. What it would do is it would be done on what's known as a parametric basis. And this product would be done so that basically, did a weather event occur or didn't it? And so if we contemplate how we would deal with, say, flood, right? Flood is a very tricky one for insurance companies to deal with. But if we were going to do a product around flood, you could do it in several different ways. You could do it with, is the rainfall in a certain location over X, right? Normal rainfall is, you know, this much, and what they view as a high level of rainfall would be, you know, Y, do we go above that? And if it hits Z, does the product pay out? We could do that, or we could look at the flow speed in a river. So if you think about, in Canada, you look Winnipeg, Canada, there's two rivers that kind of surround the city, and it's known to flood. That if you put a gauge in the river and you said if the river flow speed exceeded past X, at any given point than the product would pay out. So this way, that there's no ambiguity of or moral hazard of, oh, you know, there was a contractor who had benefits assigned to him and he left the water on in the bathroom for a couple of days and it damaged it, and it wouldn't take the time to pay out. What these products can do, and there's a great example of this in there was a bond called Multicap Mexico. And if you recall, I think it was 2015, there was Hurricane Patricia on the Pacific Coast, came in and above, I believe it was a Cat 2, it paid out 50%, and above a Cat 3, it paid out 100%. So basically, if it came across certain grid points on a map, at Cat 2, it's paying out 50%. If it crosses those same grid points at a Cat 3 or greater, then it pays out 100%. So there was a dispute as to how it was structured was based on the pressure when it crossed certain grid points, and there was a dispute as to whether it was, you know, X or Y and, you know, what have you. But it still only took about 3 to 4 months for that bond to pay out. Whereas when you look at Superstorm Sandy, the insurance companies were dealing with the payouts for some of our corporate clients for a couple of years, and the proof of loss really slowed down. So the question would be for our clients, how valuable is money right away versus going through the process and getting every penny that you're due to the damage? And there's a trade-off there, because there's a something called basis risk that is increased when the further you get away from the actual dollar for dollar loss. So I hope that makes sense for you guys. As you know, there are different ways that you can structure these and kind of go into the benefits of it for, you know, non-catastrophic risk versus cat risk. Sometimes one is better than the other in certain situations, and I'm not saying that the parametrics are better than the indemnity-based products, which are the dollar-for-dollar loss, but I think in different situations, one structurally can be more compelling than the other, depending on what the risk is.
This is a question for both of you. You can kind of have a conversation, but where do you see your business in 10 years?
Huh. Ooh. Where do we see it in 10 years? Certainly, you know, alternative capital, which is what's flowing and it's what's really driving the insurance space to look to other forms of catastrophic hedging or weather-based hedging, and which has led to, you know, sort of the success of our capital markets group. I can see, you know, in 10 years that continuing to evolve. And especially as technology gets better and better and better. I mean, Ryan mentioned this whole idea of, you know, parametric type of weather catastrophe-based hedges or risk transfer measures that are looking at, you know, parametrically. I think technology that enables us to calculate and observe and bring in more useful pieces of data and information that helps make those products even more transparent and trusted, that's really going to drive, I think, this industry forward. And I'll give one example of this. This was actually before I was working at JLT Re. I had the opportunity to work with University of California, Davis, on a really interesting microfinance product that was sort of partnered with through a couple of different entities, including a company called Swiss Re. And it was looking at how you ensure or how you provide microfinance for what are called smallholders, which are basically really small farm plots in rural parts of Africa. And the biggest obstacle to providing, in this case it was an insurance-linked security, so it was a microfinance product, something that would pay out parametrically, it was very difficult to do because they simply don't have the weather station or the weather-based network of sensors to collect the appropriate data to really provide a product that everyone can buy into. And what UC Davis was working on was actually algorithms that that are using satellite-based technology to measure what's called vegetative vigor, or how much basically how green or how much vegetation there is in an area, as a parametric means to pay out this sort of weather-based hedge. So they were using technology, they were using satellite data feeds and satellite sensors to measure how healthy crops were at the surface as a means to provide an index-based insurance product to farmers who otherwise couldn't afford insurance at all. And I think we're going to see more and more products like that come out of the new technologies that are able to provide us more cutting-edge data and information. That's what I see. Ryan, what about you?
So I think there's a couple different things, right? So if we take a look at, you know, and I just pulled this up real quick. If we take a look at what the actual, you know, catastrophe and ILS issuance rate has been since 1997, I mean, it, per annum, it's gone from 100 million to almost about 400 million. That is tracking just below the S&P rate and, you know, above the 10-year bond. So when we contemplate what the total issuance is in the cat bond market, and we talk about how, you know, the catastrophe bond space is growing and that risk transfer, it's steadily been increasing. And this is a result of the financial crisis, in that once everybody kind of realized that everything was somewhat correlated, and when I say everyone, I mean the pension funds, they started looking around, and there has been an influx of capital into this space since that time. And they're right now, which has driven the reinsurance rates lower, and they're almost at historic lows. So there are people who are starved for this type of risk. That is why the weather risk has kind of started to become more popular. The non-catastrophic weather risk transfer. And as it happens, that by the time this podcast is published, JLT will have structured the first non-catastrophic weather risk bond. We'll have issued it. It'll be settled. It'll be done since 1999. And that's done on a parametric basis covering European heat. So we'll be doing that tomorrow, actually. The growth in the industry, as I see it right now, there's only a couple, several sectors that really have embraced the concept of weather hedging as a sector, and that's really and there's a couple regions in the globe, and that's the energy markets have really done and the alternative space, where, you know, wind farms and so forth have really embraced the concept of doing this, and they have for a while. I would say Australia is very interested in this. Europe is kind of right behind them. And what we're seeing is that here in the Americas, we're gaining traction with agriculture. I'm working with government organizations in their effort, as they view to, as their mandate from their government is to mitigate man-made global warming. Now, JLT does not take a position on global warming in any direction, but our clients do have a position, and we look to help them with that. We also have clients that are oil and gas producers that, you know, we do weather hedges for them as well. And we see the applications to this just about every business line. If you take a look at some of these corporates, you know, some household names on their 10K filings as to where their risks are, their CFO will generally point to weather being a massive risk to them, and it deals with their supply chain. The possibilities, in my opinion, are endless, and it's about growing the knowledge and understanding and people, you know, kind of sometimes think like, you know, yeah, it's the weather. It's just a cost of doing business. From my perspective, you know, watching people go through that kind of transformation of, you know, hey, what was once impossible to, hey, this is, you know, not impossible anymore, and is benefiting me and protecting my balance sheet, is a pretty fascinating thing to watch, especially when you're talking to CFOs and risk managers who this is their job, and you've opened their eyes to something that they could have been protecting against that they didn't even know the product existed. So it's a very interesting and fascinating process and product to be working on.
So as the show's coming to a close here, we have one last question that we ask everyone on the show, and this might be more geared towards Brian because he has the meteorological background. So we ask everyone, what kind of advice would you give to someone who is thinking about becoming going into the industry that you're in and in business, or maybe just any area of the private sector?
You know, I would give them the same advice that I was given when I was actually working for a company called AccuWeather, which you guys, being from Penn State, you know all too well. I was working as a weather risk management analyst at the time in their enterprise solutions group, so focused on business-to-business type weather data vending and so forth. And I was given a piece of advice from my manager there, who basically said, you know, anytime, he said, Brian, anytime that you can take meteorology and pair it with one other thing, whatever that thing is, whether it's IT, whether it's engineering, whether it's understanding of financial markets or economics, computer programming, if you can combine meteorology with that one other thing, you write your own ticket. And so I'm an advocate of, you know, students or graduates with meteorology degrees who are looking to expand their ability to apply their technical meteorology knowledge to a space that's really yearning for people who truly understand fundamentally what's going on in our atmosphere and are looking to those individuals to help them, in this case, develop really unique products that help people either make or save a lot of money. And I think, you know, if a student is interested in meteorology, they should definitely consider the insurance industry. They should definitely consider the reinsurance industry, either with a broker or with a primary. They should look into the capital markets, because meteorologists are going to play an increasingly important role in how the insurance market understands and underwrites weather-related risks. So that's what I would say.
Okay, well, great advice, Brian. And this has been an awesome conversation. So thanks so much for taking some time to talk to us. And it's been a pleasure.
Great. Right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
If you don't follow this podcast on Twitter, you can follow us at the WX Junkies. We're also on Facebook. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, and iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, go ahead and give us a rating or review. Tyler, who can we expect next week?
Next week, we are pleased to have Matt Mihalik on the show. He is a research meteorologist and Penn State graduate. He is currently out in Oklahoma and is a research meteorologist for the Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies at the University of Oklahoma. So a great meteorology school. We're happy to have him on, and he will be on next week. And next week, when we're on Thursday, it's the first day of fall, so the season will be changing. We're excited to be with you next week. But for Ryan, Brian, Dakota, and me, thank you for listening to this episode, and we hope you'll join us right back here next week.